Caucalus was a little nervous about confronting the most powerful king in the Mediterranean, but he loved Daedalus. He didn't want to lose his best advisor. He went along with what the inventor said. First, Daedalus solved the conch shell puzzle. That was easy. He drilled a tiny hole at the top where the shell came to a point. He put a little drop of honey around the edge of the hole. Then he found an ant and carefully tied a silken thread around the little guy's body. Don't try this at home unless you've got tons of time, infinite patience, and a very good magnifying glass. Daedalus nudged the ant inside the shell. The ant smelled the honey at the top and took off through the spirals, dragging the thread behind it. The ant popped out of the hole and, ta-da, one threaded conch shell. Daedalus gave the conch to King Caucalus, who sent it to Minos, whose fleet was now trolling off the coast of Italy. A few weeks later, Minos received the shell, along with a note that read,
"Solved your little puzzle. What else you got? Come and give me my reward. I'm in Caucalus's palace, Sicily. XOX. Not Daedalus."
Minos saw through this clever pseudonym.
"It's Daedalus," he cried. "Quickly, we must sail for Sicily."
His fleet anchored off the southern coast of the island. The place where he landed was immediately named Minoa in honor of the king's arrival. Like I said, not much happened in Sicily back then. Still, can you imagine every place you visit being named after you? It'd be kind of annoying.
"Mom, did you go to New Jersey last night?"
Me.
No. Why do you ask?
Mom,
because there's a town named Persepolis there now.
King Caucalus sent messengers to greet Minos. They invited the king to the palace for a chat. Minos looked up at the cliff-top fortress with its narrow, winding approach and its easily defendable gate. He realized it would be impossible to take by force. He guessed Daedalus must have constructed the place. Minos gritted his teeth and decided to play along. Accompanied by a dozen guards and servants, he followed the messengers to King Caucalus's audience chamber. The king sat nervously on his throne. Behind him stood three young red-headed ladies who Minos assumed were the king's daughters.
"My friend Minos," Caucalus said.
Minos scowled. He'd never met Caucalus. He didn't want to be friends.
"I understand someone at your court solved my puzzle," he said.
"Oh, yes," Caucalus grinned. "My trusted advisor, not Daedalus. He's awesome."
"Let's cut through the mist, shall we?" Minos growled. "I know you are harboring the fugitive Daedalus."
Caucalus's smile faded.
Well...
"How did he solve the conch shell problem?"
"He, with an ant, if you can believe it. He tied a silk thread around the little guy, then coaxed it through the shell by putting a drop of honey at the other end."
"Ingenious," Minos said. "Turn Daedalus over to me, and we'll have no problem. Fail to do so, and you will have Crete as an enemy. Believe me, you don't want that."
Caucalus turned pale, which pleased Minos. He was way past the days of giving away free bobbleheads in hopes that people would like him. Now he was older and wiser. He just wanted to terrify and kill people. One of King Caucalus's daughters inched forward. She whispered in her father's ear.
"What are you saying, girl?" Minos demanded.
The princess met his eyes. "My lord, Daedalus is our teacher and friend. Turning him over to you would be treachery."
Minos clenched his jaw. This girl defending the inventor reminded him of his own daughter, Ariadne, and that was a painful subject, as you'll find out in the next chapter.
"Princess, your loyalty is misplaced," Minos warned. "Daedalus also instructed my daughter. He poisoned her mind, and she betrayed me to my enemies. Give me Daedalus now!"
King Caucalus cleared his throat.
Of course, but, there was some mention of a reward for solving the puzzle."
Minos understood greed. He clapped his hands, and his servants brought forward several heavy chests, an assload of gold, minus the ass.
"It's yours," Minos said. "Give me Daedalus, and I'll leave in peace."
"Deal."
Caucalus wiped his brow with relief.
"Guards!"
"Father, wait!"
The eldest princess set her hand on his arm.
"Your word is law. Obviously, we must do what King Minos asks, but shouldn't we entertain our guest properly first? He has traveled for many months. He must be weary. Tonight, let us give Minos a luxurious bath, fresh clothes, and a feast. Then in the morning, we will send him on his way with his prisoner and many presents."
She favored King Minos with a flirty little smile.
"My sisters and I would be honored to see to your bath personally."
"Zowie," thought King Minos. "This could work." He figured he'd won. He could see the greed and fear in King Caucalus's eyes. Sicily wouldn't dare risk a war with Crete. It had been a long, tiring trip, and he wasn't anxious to get back on a ship and sail home. Having three beautiful princesses prepare his bath and serve him a feast didn't sound so bad.
"I accept," Minos said. "Show me the hospitality of Sicily."
The three princesses escorted him to a lovely suite of rooms. They complimented him on his wealth, power, and good looks. They convinced him to leave his guards behind. After all, he was among friends. What did a big, strong king have to fear from three girls? They took Minos to the baths, where a steaming tub awaited, filled with fancy rose-scented bubble bath. As the old dude eased himself in, the princesses averted their eyes to protect their modesty, and also because he was old and hairy and gross and they didn't want to see.
"Ah," Minos said, "this is the life."
"Yes, my lord," said the eldest princess. "It's also your death."
"What now?"
She turned a knob. A hatch opened in the ceiling, and 1,000 gallons of scalding hot water dumped on top of Minos. He wailed and shrieked and died in extreme pain. Behind the towel rack, a secret door opened. Daedalus emerged.
"Well done, my princesses," said the inventor. "You were always quick learners."
The princesses hugged him.
"We couldn't let Minos arrest you," said the eldest. "You can stay with us now. Continue to advise us."
"Alas, my dear, I can't," Daedalus said. "The goddess Athena clearly isn't done cursing me. I have to move on before I bring more tragedy to this kingdom. But don't worry, you'll make excellent queens. And I have other plans."
The old inventor embraced the loyal and murderous princesses. Then he disappeared into the secret passage and was never seen in Sicily again. The princesses ran back to the throne room, crying and screaming. They reported that their honored guest Minos had accidentally slipped and fallen into the scalding hot tub. The poor man had died instantly. The Cretan guards were suspicious. When they saw the body of their king, he looked like he'd been boiled in a lobster pot. But what could they do? They were outnumbered at the palace. The fortress was too well protected for an all-out assault. To get proper revenge, they'd have to declare war, lay siege to the island, and summon more troops from 1,000 miles away. That was a lot of work for a king they'd never liked anyway. They decided to accept the princess's story that the death had been an accident. The Cretans sailed away in peace. Caucalus kept the ass load of gold. His three murderous daughters lived happily ever after and became excellent at torturing and tax collecting. And Daedalus? Some stories say that he lived his last days on the island of Sardinia, but nobody is really sure. Unless you've read some of my adventures, then you might know what happened to the old guy. But since we're sticking to the original myths and all, I'll have to leave it there. Besides, my pet hellhound is getting really sad. She knows that I'm writing about Daedalus, her former master.
Every time she hears his name, she starts to cry and chew holes in my armor.
So was Daedalus a hero? You tell me. The guy was definitely smart, but his ingenuity got him in trouble at least as often as it saved him. Comic book superheroes always get the same bit of advice. Use your powers only for good. Yeah. Daedalus didn't do that. He used his powers for greed and money and saving his own skin. But sometimes he also tried to help people. Before you make up your mind, you should hear the other side of the story. What happened in the labyrinth when a guy named Theseus came to town? It turned out Daedalus wasn't the only smart person in Crete, and Minos wasn't the only stone-cold killer. Ariadne and Theseus, they made quite a cutthroat team. Theseus slays the mighty. Oh, look, a bunny rabbit. Want to make Theseus mad? Ask him, who's your daddy? He'll smack you upside the head real quick. Nobody knows exactly who Theseus's father was. We're not even sure if he had one dad or two. The ancient Greeks argued about it for centuries. They wrote essays and stories trying to figure it out until their brains exploded. I'll try not to make your brain explode, but here's the deal. The king of Athens was a dude named Aegeus. He had lots of enemies ready to take over his kingdom and no sons to carry on the family name. He really wanted a son, and so, to get advice, he decided, you guessed it, to visit the Oracle of Delphi. Have you noticed how many of these stories have kings who wanted sons? I don't know what's up with that. You'd think no royal family ever had boys. Like Greece was littered with kings standing on the side of the road holding cardboard signs that read, "We'll work for sons. Please explain to me how to have boy children. God's bless." They should have made a deal with the Amazons, since those ladies were throwing baby boys out with the recycling, but oh well. Aegeus went to the oracle and made the usual offerings.
"O great teller of the future and inhaler of volcanic gas," said the king, "can I get a boy child over here or what?"
On her three-legged stool, the priestess shuddered as the spirit of Apollo possessed her.
"Have patience, O king. Avoid women until you return to Athens. Your son shall have a noble mother and the blood of the gods, but he must arrive in his own good time."
"What does that mean?"
"Thank you for your offering. Have a nice day."
That answer frustrated Aegeus. He grumbled all the way back to his ship and prepared for his long voyage home. If you traveled overland, Delphi wasn't that far from Athens, but back then, you never traveled overland, unless you were crazy or desperate. The roads were mostly muddy cow paths or treacherous mountain passes. The few usable stretches were infested with bandits, monsters, and tacky outlet malls. Because of this, the Greeks always traveled by boat, which wasn't exactly safe, just safer. To return to Athens, Aegeus had to sail all the way around the Peloponnese, the big, dangly chunk of land that makes up the southern Greek mainland. The trip was a pain, but since Aegeus wanted to make it home alive, he didn't have much choice. His enemies back home would love to catch him on the road, where they could ambush him, chop him into tiny pieces, and make it look like the work of random monsters or enraged sheep. So King Aegeus sailed around the Peloponnese. Every once in a while, he docked at a city and had dinner with the local king. Aegeus would share his sob story and ask his host's advice about the oracle's words. The local king would always be like,
"Oh, you want a wife? I can totally hook you up. My niece is available."
Everybody wanted a marriage alliance with a powerful city like Athens, but Aegeus remembered what the oracle had said. He was supposed to avoid women until he got home. He kept declining offers for beautiful brides, which did not make him any less grumpy. After weeks of traveling, he reached a little town called Treason, about 60 miles south of Athens. All Aegeus had to do now was cross the Saronic Gulf, and he'd be home. The king of Treason was a guy named Pittheus. Because his city was close to Athens, Pittheus and Aegeus knew each other pretty well and hung out sometimes, even though they had rival patron gods. Athens was all about Athena. Treason's patron god was Poseidon. They had good taste down there in Treason. Anyway, the two kings got to chatting about the oracle's prophecy. Pittheus said,
"Oh heck, you need a wife? I've got a single daughter. You remember Aethra, my oldest?" "Dude, I appreciate it," Aegeus said. "But I'm supposed to avoid women until I get home, so..."
"Aethra!"
called Pittheus.
"Get in here, would you?"
The princess swept into the dining hall.
"Hi!"
Aegeus's jaw hit his plate. Aethra was all kinds of gorgeous. Said Aegeus. Pittheus smirked. He knew his daughter had this effect on men.
"So, as I was saying, Aethra is single and..."
But the prophecy,"
Aegeus managed. Pittheus scratched his kingly sideburns.
"The oracle didn't say you shouldn't marry a woman, right? She said you should avoid women. Well, you've done your best. You've avoided women for weeks. You didn't ask to see my daughter. She found you. So I think we're good."
Maybe Aegeus should have argued with that logic, but he didn't. Right there in the dining room, they had a quick Vegas-style wedding. The priestess of Hera, the flowers, the Elvis impersonators, the whole bit. Then, Aethra went back to her room to change into something more comfortable, while Aegeus rushed off to reapply his deodorant, brush his teeth, and await his lovely bride in the honeymoon suite. How did Aethra feel about all this? Pro and con. Like I said earlier, women back then didn't have much choice about who they married. Aethra definitely could have done worse. Aegeus wasn't a bad-looking guy. He and her dad were friends, which meant he would probably treat her well. Athens was a big, powerful city, so that would give her a lot of street cred with the other Greek queens. On the negative side, Aethra already had a secret boyfriend, the god Poseidon. As Treason's patron, Poseidon had first noticed the princess making sacrifices to him at the seaside. He decided to court her, because Aethra was super gorgeous. In no time, she'd fallen for him. Now that she was married to another guy, Aethra didn't know what to do. After the ceremony, while her new husband was brushing his teeth, the princess slipped out of the palace. She ran down to the seashore and waded to the nearby island of Sphaeria, where she and Poseidon usually met. Poseidon was waiting for her in a hammock between two palm trees. He was rocking a Tommy Bahama shirt and Bermuda shorts while drinking a fruity beverage out of a coconut shell.
"Hey, babe," he said. "What's new?"
"Well, I got married."
"Say what?"
Aethra told him what had happened.
I suppose I could run away with you," she offered hopefully.
Poseidon smiled. He liked Aethra, but not that much. Gods always moved on, eventually. This seemed like as good a time as any.
No, he said. "Aegeus is a good guy. For an Athenian, he'll make you a fine husband. This will have to be goodbye for us, babe, but it's been great. Honestly."
He snapped his fingers. A disco ball lowered from one of the palm trees. Last Dance began playing in the background because Poseidon was a total sucker for Donna Summer. Don't ask me. It's impossible to hang out in his palace without him playing that old disco stuff. Anyway, they had one more quality evening together. Then Aethra hurried off to see her new husband, who must have been really careful about brushing his teeth, because he didn't notice how long his bride had been gone or the fact that she smelled like sea breeze aftershave. Aethra and Aegeus spent their honeymoon in Treason. Aegeus wasn't anxious to get home, since all he had waiting for him there were problems and enemies. After a few weeks, the king started having strange dreams about his new wife swimming across the Saronic Gulf with a baby boy in her arms. Finally, he asked Aethra about this. She blushed.
"Well, I'm pretty sure I'm pregnant."
"That's awesome," said Aegeus.
"Except I'm not sure if you're the dad."
She confided to her husband about her fling with Poseidon. Aegeus took the news better than you might expect. The gods were always falling in love with mortal princesses. He couldn't blame Aethra for being swept off her feet by an immortal hunk with supernatural good looks and limitless power. And he couldn't curse Poseidon without getting hit by a tsunami or swallowed by an earthquake.
"Okay, I understand," said Aegeus. "But if the child is a boy, I'm going to claim him as my son, all right?"
"What if it's a girl?"
Aethra asked. Aegeus sighed.
"Let's think positive. A boy would be awesome. I'll make some arrangements."
"Arrangements?"
"You'll see."
The next day, Aegeus took Aethra to a hill outside the city. At the crest stood a boulder the size of a two-car garage. A dozen of the king's men had wrapped ropes around the boulder and were harnessing them to a team of horses.
"Whoa," Aethra said. "You're going to move that rock?"
"Yeah, here's the deal."
Aegeus walked over to a shallow pit next to the boulder. He unbuckled his sword.
"This sword's hilt has the royal crest of Athens on it, see?"
"The owl and the olive branch?"
"Yeah, and those are my initials on the pommel. It's an excellent blade, celestial bronze and everything."
He tossed the sword into the pit.
"I'm also burying these."
From one of his servants, he took a polished wooden shoebox. He opened it for Aethra, and inside were, you guessed it, shoes. Aethra whistled.
"Those are some nice sandals."
"Oh, yeah. Leather soles, good quality straps, arch support. These shoes will last a lifetime."
Aegeus tossed the shoebox in the pit. Now, you might be wondering, what was the big deal about a pair of shoes? But back then, good kicks were super hard to find. You couldn't just stroll into Foot Locker and score some Adidas. If you wanted to be a hero, making your way through monster lairs, viper's nests, and battlefields, you didn't want to go barefoot. You definitely didn't want to be slipping on blood and gore in a cheap pair of flip-flops. Good shoes could keep you alive just as well as a good sword. Aegeus's men grabbed the ropes. The lines went taut. The team of horses strained. Very slowly, they dragged the giant rock until it covered the pit.
"There," Aegeus said. "If our child is a boy, wait until he comes of age and then tell him that I left him some gifts under this rock. If he can retrieve them, he is worthy of being my son. He should then make his way to Athens."
Aethra frowned.
"You want me to tell him this? Where will you be?"
"My dear, you know those strange dreams I've been having? They're getting worse. If you come with me to Athens, I'm sure my enemies will kill you. They'll never allow you to give birth to my heir. Even if the child were born, he'd never be safe in Athens. It's best I return home alone and keep our marriage a secret. That way my enemies will think I've failed to have a son. They'll be content to wait for me to die. Once my son is old enough to defend himself, he can come to Athens and take his rightful place as the crown prince."
"So you want me to stay here and raise the kid by myself for like 16, 17 years?
"That would be great, thanks."
Aegeus kissed her.
"Well, my ship is waiting in the harbor. Love you. Have a good pregnancy."
Aegeus sailed back to Athens and left Aethra in treason to wait for her child to be born. She kind of hoped she would have a girl, because then she could rest easy. Neither Aegeus nor Poseidon would care, being the enlightened feminist guys that they were. Aethra could raise her daughter in peace and not have to worry about shoes under boulders. But if the child were a boy, well, Aethra at least hoped he would grow up to be a hero. Then both of his dads would be proud to claim him. As you can probably guess, She had a boy, and the Greek storytellers spent the next 1,000 years arguing who his dad was. Some said Aegeus, some said Poseidon, some said he had 2 fathers, which I'm pretty sure is medically impossible. Then again, we're talking about gods, so who knows? As for Aethra, she raised her son by herself for the first 17 years, which took a special kind of heroism. Aethra's son was big and healthy, which you'd expect, since he had 1 or 2 powerful dads. She named him Theseus, meaning the gathering. Maybe because she hoped he would gather all the people of Greece together into one big happy family. Or maybe because the kid was so high energy that Aethra and 12 nursemaids had to spend all day trying to gather him up. Most demigods I've met have attention deficit / hyperactivity disorder. It keeps you alive on the battlefield because you're so aware of everything. But Theseus was the original ADHD poster child. He was hyper in diapers. He was bouncing off the Corinthian columns. He was the super caffeinated kid, the deficit demigod. You get the idea. The kid was a handful. As he grew, he quickly ran out of things to do and bad guys to kill. All the monsters near treason? Toast. Bandits, murderers, evil geniuses trying to take over ancient Greece? Forget it. They were dead before Theseus's nap time. By the time he was 17, Theseus was so skillful in combat and so incredibly bored that his mom decided to send him to his father's city. She needed a break. She led him to the hill with a huge boulder. "My son," she said, "your real father is Aegeus, king of Athens, or he might be Poseidon, god of the sea, or possibly both." She tried to explain the details, but Theseus lost interest.
"What's with the rock?"
"Aegeus said that when you are old enough, I should bring you here. If you can figure out a way to move the boulder and retrieve the gifts beneath, you should seek out your father in Athens."
"Gifts? Cool."
Theseus walked once around the boulder, then pressed his hands against the stone.
"Don't get a hernia," his mother warned. "Your father used 12 men and a team of horses to..."
Boom!
The boulder toppled over and rolled downhill. Theseus had the attention span of a gerbil, but he was a genius at sizing up his opponents, even if that opponent was a large rock. He had noticed immediately that the boulder was lopsided and top-heavy on the left. Over the past 17 years, the soil on that side had eroded. All Theseus had to do was give the stone a good push on the right, and down it went. Of course, Theseus wasn't so good about foreseeing consequences. The boulder barreled through a nearby village, destroying several huts and scaring some pigs before rolling to a stop.
"Sorry,"
Theseus yelled downhill. He knelt by the pit where the boulder had stood.
"Nice sword. And, oh, shoes."
Theseus strapped on the sandals. He ran a few laps around the hilltop to break them in.
"These fit great."
"Yes," said his mother. "They have excellent arch support, but, Theseus, about your destiny."
"Right."
He leaped around like a ballet dancer.
"How do I get to Athens?"
"There are 2 routes, his mother said. "One is an easy trip by sea, directly across the Saronic Gulf."
"Boring."
Theseus drew his sword and continued to jog in circles, slashing at imaginary enemies, though his mother had told him 1,000 times not to run with sabers.
"The other way is by land," Aethra said, "which is extremely dangerous and infested with tacky outlet moles. The journey will take you many days and might get you killed."
"Awesome."
Aethra knew he would say that. He was always picking the most dangerous path, and she figured she'd better warn him of what lay ahead.
"I know of at least 6 deadly enemies on that road," she said. "I'll tell you about them. Try to pay attention."
Theseus jumped about, slicing the air.
"Yeah, I'm totally listening."
Aethra told him everything she knew. It was hard for her to concentrate with Theseus doing his kung fu sandal fighter routine. She doubted he heard a word she said.
"Please, son," she pleaded. "The six villains along the road to Athens are much worse than the local bandits you're used to. They've made land travel between treason and Athens impossible for generations."
"Then I will kill them and make the road safe."
Theseus kissed his mother and went running down the hill, waving his new saber.
"Bye, Mom. Thanks for everything."
Aethra exhaled. Without Hurricane Theseus blowing through the palace, she might finally get a good night's sleep. She wasn't too worried about her son on the road, but the bandits and monsters, they had no idea what was coming their way. It didn't take long for Theseus to find his first enemy, which was good, because he needed to burn off some energy. He was sloshing down a muddy path, enjoying the scenic landscape of dead trees and burned-out villages, when he happened across a big, ugly man standing in the road. Across his shoulder was a gleaming bronze club. Around his feet, the ground was littered with fuzzy, smashed spheres, like moldy cantaloupes. As Theseus got closer, he realized the cantaloupes were human heads, all sprouting from the mud, still attached to bodies that had been buried upright. Apparently, the unfortunate travelers had been used for an evil game of whack-a-mole.
"Halt!"
roared the guy with the club, which was stupid, since Theseus had already stopped to admire the bashed heads.
"Give me all your valuables, and then I will kill you."
The bandit stood about 7 feet tall. He was slightly smaller than an armored truck, and his face was so ugly and swollen, it looked like he washed it with fire ants. His arms rippled with muscles, but his legs were shriveled and twisted, encased from thigh to ankle in bronze braces.
"I've heard of you," Theseus said. "You're Periphetus."
See, he really had been listening to his mom's stories, which proves that you should never underestimate an ADHD hero. We soak up way more information than you might give us credit for. Running around while swinging a sword is just our way of concentrating. Anyway, this guy Periphetus, pronounced pair of feet-is, was a demigod son of Hephaestus, who had inherited his dad's strength and his deformed legs. He squinted so much that people sometimes thought he only had one eye, and they mistook him for a cyclops. No offense to my cyclops friends and family. Periphetus puffed up his huge chest.
"My legend precedes me. If you know who I am, you know it is useless to resist." "What's with all the heads?" Theseus asked. "Did you bury them and then kill them, or..."
Periphetus laughed.
"I pounded them into the ground with my club. That's what I do. My nickname is the Clubber."
"Oh."
Theseus scratched his armpit.
"I thought they called you the Clubber because you went to a lot of discos."
"What? No. I am violent and terrifying, and I smash people into the mud."
"So, we can't hit some parties tonight, chat up the ladies, do some boogieing?"
Periphetus scowled. He wasn't used to being asked to boogie.
"I will rob you and kill you, puny boy. Those are nice shoes. Give them to me."
He brandished his mighty club, but Theseus didn't tremble in terror the way he was supposed to.
"That is a fine club," Theseus said. "Is it wood covered with bronze?"
Pride warmed Periphetus's heart. He was a vicious murderer, but he was also a son of Hephaestus. He liked it when people appreciated his craftsmanship.
"Why, yes, a solid oak core wrapped in 20 sheets of bronze. I find it gives me a really good swing."
Theseus scowled.
20 sheets of bronze? Come on, man, that would make it too heavy for anyone to carry."
"I am strong."
"Are you sure that's not styrofoam wrapped in aluminum foil?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Prove it. Let me check it out."
Periphetus couldn't see any harm. He figured this puny boy would collapse under the weight of the club, which would be good for a laugh. He passed his club to Theseus. Instead of collapsing, Theseus swung it and smacked Periphetus upside the head, killing him instantly.
"Yup," Theseus said. "That's bronze over wood, all right. Thanks, man. I think I'll keep this."
Periphetus didn't argue, since he was dead. Theseus slung his new favorite weapon over his shoulder and continued traveling, occasionally darting into the woods to look at squirrels, racing ahead to check out shiny objects in the road, or stopping randomly to stare at bugs. That's where the old saying comes from: walk aimlessly and carry a big stick. I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. As Theseus moved north, the smarter monsters and bandits got out of his way. The dumber ones got their heads smashed in. After a few days, Theseus arrived at the narrow land bridge that connected the Peloponnese to the northern mainland called Attica. Since this was a natural choke point, it was also prime bandit real estate. Theseus was strolling through a forest of tall pine trees when he saw a dude dressed like a lumberjack, jeans, flannel shirt, bushy black beard, and a cap over his curly hair. Somehow, the guy had bent a 50-foot pine tree and was pinning its top to the ground with both hands. The man grinned when he saw Theseus.
"Hello, stranger. My name is Sinis, and over there is my daughter Perigone."
A pretty young lady in a flannel dress peeked out from behind a tree. She waved nervously. Her expression said, "Flee, please." Theseus smiled at the lumberjack.
"Why are you holding a pine tree to the ground?" "Oh, it's just a hobby of mine," said Sinis. "They call me the Pine Bender." "Catchy nickname." "Yeah, I like to challenge people. Anybody who can hold down a pine tree like I'm doing now can marry my daughter. Nobody yet has been able to do it. You want to give it a try?"
Theseus came closer. He could see Sinis' limbs trembling. Holding down a fully grown pine tree, even for this dude with lots of muscles and lots of experience, was not easy. Luckily, Aethra had told Theseus about Sinis, so he knew what to expect. Sinis was a son of Poseidon. He'd inherited his dad's super strength and the ability to keep his footing in almost any situation. I guess because Poseidon was the Earthshaker and could make even the roots of the Earth tremble. I didn't inherit those traits from Poseidon, but I'll try not to be bitter. When Sinis was young, he had amused himself by bending tall trees and then letting them go, catapulting watermelons and cute forest animals into the stratosphere. He was a swell guy that way. Then he realized he could catapult humans. All he had to do was trick them or force them into holding the top of the tree when it was on the ground. Over the years, he'd perfected his hobby. Sometimes he tied his victims' hands to the treetop so they couldn't loosen their grip. Sometimes he bent two trees at once. Then, since his hands were full, he would command Perigone to tie his victim's left arm to one tree and his right arm to the other. Then Sinis would let both trees go at once. Boy, that was super fun. You never knew how much of the victim would fly off in either direction.
"Interesting challenge," Theseus said. "Theoretically speaking, what happens if I decline?" "Oh, well then, theoretically speaking, you'd be insulting my daughter's beauty, so I'd insist on an even tougher challenge. I'd tie you to two pine trees, one to each wrist. I'd force you to hold them both down as long as you could. And when you eventually got tired..."
"Gotcha," Theseus said. "So I can hold down one pine tree for a chance at the beautiful girl, or I can hold down two pine trees and win certain death."
"You're a quick learner."
"What if I just run away?"
Sinis laughed.
"Good luck with that. See all those skeletons littered among the pine cones?"
"I was wondering about those."
"Those are the guys who declined my challenge. I've never lost in hand-to-hand combat, so fighting me is futile. And if you try to run, well, I'm deadly accurate up to 3 miles with a pine tree catapult. I can peg you with a flying boulder or a moose.
I've no desire to be hit by a flying moose, Theseus said. I'm up for the one tree challenge.
Excellent. Come on over.
Theseus put his club aside. He approached the pine bender and sized up the situation. He wasn't as strong as Sinis. He didn't have the ability to root himself to the earth. He didn't even have a plan. But he glanced over at the girl Perigone, and his distractible brain started racing.
A girl in the trees. A girl. A tree. Trees have spirits. I'm hungry. Wow, Sinis smells bad. A dryad. I bet the dryads in these trees are really tired of getting bent. Hey, there's a chipmunk.
Any day now,
Sinis muttered, sweat trickling down his neck. Theseus touched the branches of the pine with his fingertips. He thought,
hello in there. You want to get rid of this pine bender guy? Help me out.
He wasn't sure if the dryad heard him, but he gripped the top of the tree.
Got it?
Sinis asked.
I want to be sure you have a firm grip.
He was very courteous to people he was about to murder.
Yeah,
Theseus said.
I got it.
Okay, but just for safety.
Sinis carefully took one hand off the tree. From his back pocket, he pulled a leather strap. He tied Theseus's left wrist to the tree, which isn't easy to do one-handed, but Sinis had a lot of practice.
There you go. Now you are properly buckled in for your trip. See you.
Sinis jumped back. He expected the pine to spring skyward as usual, launching Theseus into orbit, probably minus his left arm. The tree didn't move. Theseus held it firmly to the ground. Maybe the spirit of the tree helped him. Also, Theseus was strong and smart. He knew how to apply the least amount of pressure to get the maximum results, like, for instance, to send a massive boulder rolling through a village. He kept his feet firmly planted. His arms weren't even straining.
So, he said, how long do I have to hold this before I win your daughter?
Sinis overcame his shock.
I'm amazed you're still managing, little man. But you're only human. Eventually you'll run out of strength. Then you'll die. Oh, I see, said Theseus. In that case, I'd better get comfortable. This safety strap really chafes.
He took one hand off the tree. The tree still went nowhere. He drew his sword and began sawing off the leather strap.
What are you doing?
Sinis cried.
If you think you can just step away from this challenge...
No, no, I'll keep holding the tree.
Theseus sheathed his sword. He continued to hold the pine with one hand.
I can do this all day. How long do you want to wait?
Theseus was betting that Sinis, being a demigod, was just as ADHD as he was. Sure enough, in about 10 seconds, Sinis got impatient.
This is impossible. What's your secret?
It's all about the grip, Theseus said. Come here, I'll show you.
Sinis edged forward.
Okay, Theseus said. See how the top of my hand is positioned?
Sinis couldn't see through the pine needles unless he leaned over and looked directly down. When he did, Theseus let go of the tree. The pine sprang up, smacking Sinis in the face and knocking him out cold. Hours later, the pine bender woke from a dream about flying moose. He was groggy. His mouth tasted like a Christmas tree. He realized he was lying spread-eagled on the forest floor. Theseus's grinning face hovered above him.
Good, you're up.
What?
Listen, I was thinking about that two-tree challenge. I thought you could show me how it's done.
Sinis struggled. His wrists were firmly bound.
What have you done?
Well, I've got two pine trees bent to the ground right behind your head. I'm holding them both down with my foot. Your wrists are tied to them, so if I were you, I'd get up and get ready.
Sinis yelped. He struggled to rise, which wasn't easy with his hands tied. He had to do a sort of crab-walk somersault to get a grip on the trees.
You can't do this!
Whoops!
Theseus stepped back, leaving Sinis to hold the pines. Sinis had been bending trees all his life. He was super strong and could keep his footing in almost any situation. But now he was groggy and in pain. The two trees seemed to be actively fighting him, straining to be free. The pines felt angry.
How?
Sinis wailed.
How could you possibly hold down both trees and tie me up?
I had help.
The bandit's daughter peeped out from behind a tree. Hi, Dad.
Perigony. No. Release me.
Sorry, Dad. This handsome man won your contest, so I belong to him now. Bye.
Theseus picked up his club. He and Perigony walked away, hand in hand, while Sinis screamed behind them.
You sure you're okay with this, Perigony?
Theseus asked.
Ugh, yes. My dad is horrible. It was only a matter of time before he flung me into the sky.
I wonder how long he can hold down those trees.
From behind them came a stifled wail, followed by the whoosh of two trees snapping upward and a sound like a 500-pound bug hitting a windshield.
Not long, Perigony said. You want to get some dinner? I'm starving.
They walked to the nearest town and spent a few nice days together. Some stories say that Perigony even had kids with Theseus, but I wasn't there, so I'm not going to gossip. After a while, Theseus explained that he had to keep traveling. He had business in Athens. Perigony had seen enough of the road and evil bandits, so she decided to stay put and make a new life for herself. They parted as BFFs. After another lovely day in the wastelands, Theseus came to a village called Crumian. In the town square, a crowd of locals was wailing and sobbing. Theseus wondered if they were upset because they had to live in a village called Crumian. Then he realized they were gathered around the mangled body of an old man.
What happened to him?
Theseus asked. A boy looked up with tears in his eyes.
It's that old lady and her pig.
Excuse me?
Theseus asked.
Phaia!
The boy shouted.
She lives out in the wilderness with her massive man-eating sow.
They're both monsters, a woman cried. That sow has destroyed the entire countryside. It eats our crops, kills our farmers, knocks down our houses. Then that old lady Phaia comes along afterward and loots our valuables.
I can fix that,
Theseus said.
Let me kill the old lady and her pig.
That may not sound like the most heroic promise, but the townspeople gasped and groveled before Theseus as if he'd dropped from Mount Olympus. He did look sort of like a god. He had a huge bronze club, an expensive sword, and incredibly nice shoes.
Who are you, O stranger?
One guy asked.
I am Theseus, son of Aegeus, king of Athens, also son of Poseidon, god of the sea, also son of Aethra, princess of treason.
The peasants fell silent as they tried to do the math.
Never mind, Theseus said. I will kill the bandit Phaia and her pet monster, the Crumianian sow.
Oh, please don't call it that, said a farmer. We don't want our town to be immortalized because of a man-eating pig.
And so the pig was forever after called the Crumianian sow, and that's the only thing the village is remembered for. Theseus roamed the countryside, searching for the offending porker. She wasn't hard to find. Theseus simply followed the trail of dead bodies, trampled crops, and burning farmsteads. The sow was as big as a barn, which was an easy comparison since she was standing in the shell of one, rooting around for dead farmers. Her mottled gray hide was covered with sword-sized bristles. Her hooves were caked with splattered gore, and her smell? Wow. Even from across the field, the stench almost knocked Theseus out. He doubted he'd ever be able to eat bacon again.
Hey, pig!
he yelled.
Tasty yum yum!
Those were the magic words. The pig turned, saw a juicy morsel of hero, and charged. I can tell you from personal experience, there is nothing cute or funny about a charging giant pig. When you see those mean dark eyes and that toothy snout coming at you, oh yes, they have teeth. All you want to do is run screaming to the nearest pig-proof bunker. Theseus held his ground. At the last second, he dodged to the left and stuck the pig with his sword. The sow squealed in rage. She turned and charged again. This time, Theseus dodged to the right. Another thing about giant pigs, they aren't very smart, and they can't turn worth crud. Don't ever try to parallel park one. It won't work. Theseus played matador until the pig was exhausted and bleeding from so many wounds it just collapsed in the field. Then Theseus walked over, hefted his bronze club, and said nighty-night to the Crumionian sow. Theseus was wiping the pig blood off his club when he heard a shriek. A fat woman in a sackcloth dress was hobbling toward him, a large battle axe in her hands. Her skin was mottled gray. Her hair stuck up in a dark thicket of bristles.
"Are you related to this pig?" Theseus asked. "Because you look..."
"That's my pet, you idiot!" the woman screamed. "What have you done?"
"You must be Fea."
"Yes, and that pig made me good money in the banditry business."
"Well, ma'am, I'm gonna have to cite you for keeping livestock inside the Crumian village limits. Also for killing, pillaging, and being ugly without a license."
The woman raised her battle axe.
"Die!"
Pro tip. If you come across a well-armed hero who has just killed a giant sow, it is not smart to yell,
"Die!"
and charge him with an axe. Soon, Fea was lying dead alongside her pig. Theseus cleaned his sword on her sackcloth dress. He could have gone back to Crumian and told the people what had happened, but he figured they'd find out soon enough. Also, there really wasn't much to do in Crumian once you'd killed the giant pig, so Theseus hit the road. By this time, Theseus had developed a personal philosophy about killing things. He would only attack if he were attacked first, and whenever possible, he would defeat his enemies the same way they tried to defeat him. Smack Theseus with a club, he'd take your club and kill you with it. Tie Theseus to a pine tree, he'd tie you to two pine trees. Not only was this system fair, it was fun. He only regretted that he couldn't kill Fea with her own giant pig, but philosophy will only take you so far. One afternoon, Theseus was strolling along the top of a 100-foot cliff, because heroes do that sort of thing. The sea glittered far below. The sun felt warm and pleasant on his face. It was so peaceful and relaxing. Theseus started to feel antsy. Fortunately, about 50 feet in front of him, a bandit jumped out from behind a rock and yelled,
"Stand and deliver!"
The guy was dressed in dusty black clothes, leather sandals, not as nice as Theseus's, and a wide-brimmed black hat. A scarf covered the lower part of his face. He aimed a crossbow bolt at Theseus. Theseus grinned.
"Man, am I glad to see you."
The guy's crossbow dipped.
"You are?"
he asked.
"Yeah, I was bored."
The bandit blinked.
"Well, okay then. This is a robbery. Give me all your goodies. That sword. That club. Definitely those shoes. Those are nice shoes."
"I don't suppose there's any way to avoid a confrontation here, because I'm trying not to kill people unless they attack me."
The bandit laughed.
"You kill me? Good one. I'll tell you what. If you wash my feet as a show of respect, I won't kill you. I'll take your valuables, but you'll keep your life. That's the best deal you're going to get."
The mention of foot washing triggered Theseus's memory.
"Oh, my mom told me about you. You must be Siron."
The bandit puffed up his chest.
"Of course I am. I'm famous. Siron, son of Poseidon. Number 6 on the Forbes list of top 10 richest bandits."
"Hey, I'm a son of Poseidon too," Theseus said.
You wouldn't rob a brother, would you?
Relatives are my favorite victims. Now wash my feet. Right here at the edge of this cliff is good. Don't worry, I won't kick you off.
Theseus peered over the edge. 100 feet below, a massive round shape was moving under the waves.
Is that a huge turtle down there?
Yes, that's my pet.
He doesn't eat humans, does he? For instance, if you kicked your victims off this cliff like you said you wouldn't do.
My turtle is a she. Her name is Molly. And of course she doesn't eat humans. What a silly idea.
As if having a giant turtle named Molly wasn't already silly. Siren leveled his crossbow.
Now wash my feet or die. There's a bucket and rag behind that rock. And bring the disinfectant spray. You'll definitely need that.
Theseus carefully set down his weapons. Siren kept his crossbow trained on Theseus's chest as the hero retrieved the foot washing supplies and knelt in front of the bandit.
Have fun!
Siren planted his left foot on a rock, positioning himself so Theseus would have his back to the sea. One swift kick, and Siren would be able to send him over the edge. Fortunately, Theseus was expecting that. He whistled as he undid Siren's sandal straps. The bandit's toes were hairy and caked with unknown substances. In the crevices of his big toenail, green algae were close to developing an agricultural society. The disgustingness of the feet distracted Theseus, but since he was always distracted, it didn't matter. He felt Siren's leg tense. Just before the bandit kicked, Theseus dropped sideways. Siren stumbled, off balance, and Theseus booted him in the butt, sending him over the edge.
Wah!
Siren flailed his arms, but sadly, Poseidon's demigod children do not get the power to fly. The giant turtle's head broke the surface. She opened her huge maw.
No, Molly!
Siren cried.
It's me!
Gulp.
Molly apparently didn't mind biting the hand that fed her, or swallowing the rest of him either. Theseus washed his own hands with antibacterial spray and continued on his way. Finally, he reached the end of the land bridge and crossed into Attica. Annabeth tells me a narrow strip of land connecting two big chunks of land is called an isthmus. I can't pronounce that, but there you go, geography freaks. Theseus arrived at the city of Eleusis, which was famous for its Temple of Demeter. But instead of selling Demeter-themed tourist junk and offering guided tours of the site, the locals were screaming and running around looking for places to hide.
What's going on?
Theseus asked one guy.
The king! He's insane! He wants to wrestle!
Theseus frowned. His mom had warned him about Cercyon, the king of Eleusis. Apparently the guy was mean and strong and liked to kill travelers, but she hadn't said anything about wrestling. Theseus made his way to the ceremonial hearth in the middle of town. Usually that was the safest place in any Greek city. Travelers and ambassadors would go there to pledge their peaceful intentions and accept the town's hospitality. Now the town's hospitality consisted of a bear of a man stomping around the hearth in a glittering gold cape, gold spandex briefs, and a mask with big eye holes that looked suspiciously like a pair of underwear.
"Who will wrestle me?"
roared the underwear man.
"I am Cercyon the king."
"Wow,"
Theseus said.
"Your outfit is shiny."
"Raw!"
Cercyon randomly darted across the street to the Temple of Demeter, punched his fist through a marble column, and collapsed the entire front porch.
"Hey, now," said Theseus. "You shouldn't be damaging temples. Also, that can't be good for your fist."
"I am Cercyon,"
said Cercyon.
"Defeat me at wrestling, and you can be the king. Otherwise, I will kill you."
The king paused, like he'd forgotten what he was doing. Probably the strain of putting so many words together had overheated his brain. Theseus considered what to do. Obviously, King Cercyon had gone off the deep end. Maybe the gods had cursed him with insanity for all those years he'd been killing travelers and building up his evil reputation. Theseus didn't want to kill an insane person, but he also couldn't have Circe in terrifying the locals, destroying temples, and rampaging around in gold spandex shorts.
"So if I beat you at wrestling," Theseus said, "I get to be king?"
"Yes!"
"Do I have to wear underwear on my head?"
"Yes!"
Theseus set down his sword and club.
"Do I have to kill you, or will you accept defeat if I just pin you down?"
"That will never happen," Circean said, "because I will break your spine."
Theseus winced.
"I wish you hadn't said that. See, I've got this philosophy."
"Roar!"
Circean charged. Theseus dodged the king's first attack. Circean was big and strong, but he was as clumsy as a giant sow. Theseus was familiar with those. Circean charged again. This time Theseus sidestepped. He kicked Circean in the back, the way he'd done with Siren. The wrestler stumbled into the hearth and came out screaming, his glittery cape on fire.
"Death!"
Circean yelled. Theseus put his back to the temple. As Circean barreled toward him, Theseus dove between the big man's legs, and the wrestler obligingly ran face first into the marble wall. The wall cracked. Circean's face didn't fare too well either. He stumbled and collapsed. Summoning all his strength, Theseus picked up the groggy king and lifted him over his head. Terrified townspeople came out of their hiding places. A crowd gathered as Theseus paraded the wrestler around the square.
"Give up, Circean," said Theseus, "and I'll spare your life."
"Never,"
mumbled the crazy man.
"Break your spine."
Theseus sighed.
"Well, folks, you heard him."
He dropped the king over his knee in a total Bane Breaks Batman move. Circean fell to the ground, dead. Theseus ripped off the king's mask. He held it up for the people to see.
"Guys," he yelled, "you really should not follow orders from people who wear underwear on their heads. Also, the whole wrestling to the death thing is stupid."
"Hail our new king," someone cried.
"Oh no," Theseus said. "I've got my own gig. Who's the smartest guy in town?"
The crowd hesitantly pointed to an old dude with a white beard, maybe the local philosopher.
"You're the king now," Theseus said. "Do a good job. Fix the temple, dispose of this wrestler's body, and never wear an underwear mask."
"I understand, hero," said the old man.
So Theseus left the town of Eleusis in much better hands, and with a lot less spandex. Theseus was so close to Athens he could smell it. I mean that literally. Back then, sanitation wasn't great. A city the size of Athens stank so bad you could smell it from 20 miles away. Theseus was tired, though. The sun was going down. He figured he'd sleep on the road one more night and walk to Athens the next day. He stopped at the worst, tackiest outlet mall on the entire highway. Outside the nearest shop, a big sign read, "Krusty's Slightly Used Beds. Stay the night with us." Theseus couldn't tell if the place was a hotel or a mattress store or what, but with a sign like that, he couldn't resist checking it out. Plus, there were a lot of donkeys tied up in the parking lot, so he figured the place must be popular. Strange thing, inside, he found no customers, just a dingy showroom with a low ceiling, guttering olive oil lamps, and two nasty old beds. One was about 10 feet long, the other was about 4 feet long. That must have really driven the ancient Greeks crazy. Like I said, they were a bunch of Goldilockses. They always wanted the middle option that was just right. At Krusty's Slightly Used Beds, there wasn't one. Just a bed that was way too long and a bed that was way too short.
"Welcome!"
The proprietor emerged from behind a curtain in the back. At first, Theseus thought it was Siren's turtle, Molly. The guy had a huge, leathery head with absolutely no hair. He wore a full-length black leather apron, like butchers wear, and as he walked over, he wiped his hands like he just finished washing blood off them. His name tag read, "Hi, I'm Krusty."
"You're Krusty?"
Theseus asked.
"Why, yes, I am. My real name is Procrustes."
"Which means the stretcher,"
Theseus noted.
"Okay, I've heard of you. I didn't recognize the name from just Krusty."
"Well, Krusty is easier for most people to remember. It looks better on the sign out front, too. Anyway, welcome to my humble mattress shop and motel. May I interest you in a slightly used waterbed?"
"Waterbed?"
Krusty snapped his fingers.
"Sorry, I forgot those haven't been invented yet. But I do have two lovely standard models. These are our most popular choices."
"They're also your only choices," Theseus observed.
Krusty chuckled.
"I can tell you're a smart customer. So which model appeals to you? The Krusty XL or the Krusty Nano?"
Theseus examined the larger bed.
"That's the XL. It's pretty long."
"Yes, but don't worry. See those leather straps at the top and the bottom? If you don't fit exactly, I will stretch you until you do."
"So you'll stretch me until I'm 10 feet long, and if I can't survive that much elongation?"
"Well, you'll die, obviously. Those stains on the mattress are from previous customers who, came apart. I did say slightly used."
Theseus examined the smaller bed. The baseboard and headboard were caked with dried brown gunk.
"Your Krusty Nano looks kind of crusty."
"If you don't fit in the Nano, I just lop off the bits that hang out on either end."
Krusty whipped out a knife from his apron pocket.
"So what'll it be?"
"I suppose just browsing isn't an option."
"Nope."
"How's the firmness on the Nano mattress? I can't sleep if it's too soft."
"Oh, it's excellent."